You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.
Today on our show, we're talking with Ethan and Thea. We're here in their beautiful apartment in Soho. Thank you, Thea and Ethan.
Welcome.
Thank you.
So perhaps we should begin with how you both met and got involved in the arts, if that's okay to begin with.
Both Ethan and I were collecting individually, and both of us were interested in art. I more aggressively and more immediately so because I was in the middle of the New York art world, and Ethan was at that point living on the West Coast. And interestingly enough, there was a dealer that he was visiting on the West Coast, and he just happened to mention, you know, Jeannie, I would really love to find a great woman. Any ideas? And she asked Ethan to describe what kind of woman that was. And of course he said somebody brilliant, somebody beautiful, somebody lively.
I said very smart, lively, and I had just gotten divorced and started dating. And I was absolutely convinced I would live my life alone. And I happened to be in a conversation with this, as Thea mentions, this art dealer I was then living in my house in Watermill, New York. And out of frustration, because I don't typically share those kinds of feelings, I said, you know, I'm never going to find anybody and... I'm finished. I'm going to live my life alone. And she said, well, what kind of person are you looking for? And I said, I wanted somebody sophisticated and really intelligent. And if they knew something about art, great. She named Thea. And I happened to have met Thea because I once went to her office to purchase a book that she had was publishing with Sophie Kahl. And my memory of Thea from that time, because she gave me the bum's rush right out the door because Sophie happened to be there at the moment and I knew Sophie and wanted to talk, and Thea didn't want any part of this guy from somewhere on the West Coast bothering her when she's meeting with somebody she's collaborated with.
Well, we were working on another project, and he comes in and, you know, oh, Sophie, it's so nice to see you, and blah, blah.
So the long and the short of it is I vaguely remembered her, and I said, yeah, I'd be interested. Why don't you see if she would welcome a call? And then we've been together ever since. The first conversation we had, I called her. She had just gotten back from Truro.
No, it's Truro.
And I, as I said, I was out in Watermill. And so the conversation was such that it was an hour-long conversation, and I was intrigued, and she was overwhelmed.
Well, I think the most interesting thing about that moment was that we talked about two basic things, what Ethan did professionally, which was politics and public affairs consulting, and what I did, which was art advising, and the amount of interest that we both had in the other was just compelling. And to this day, we can sit here and, you know, read Art Forum in the New York Times, and it doesn't matter which we're focused on, we're both very engaged and compelled by what's there to discuss.
And how was it that you were interested in art, or you were, to begin with, way before you met, were your parents interested in art? Did it just come out of yourselves? Or?
No, that's one thing we share. Neither of our parents had any connection with the arts. I grew up without any connection to visual art. It was only when I started working in the legislature, it happened that a former boss of mine, who was a state legislator, gave my ex-wife and me a painting. The idea of having something made by the hand of an artist to be banal was, at that point in my life, it was fascinating. And then I started to travel a lot when I started my consulting firm, and I was in Washington very often on business, and at the end of the day, to kind of get my head out of the business stuff, I'd go over to the National Gallery and go through the Chester Dale rooms, and I was totally intrigued by that. It just excited me. And like a lot of other collectors. You start with I started with baby steps, you know, going here and there. Again, living most of my time in California, I got interested in ceramics in the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. That was short-lived. That led me to somehow to outsider art, which I still admire today, but it wasn't holding my interest. And then I started sort of pursuing contemporary art. And as the months and years proceeded, I got more and more confident, more and more involved, more and more engaged, to the point where in my home office was totally covered with the latest magazines and books of artists that I was interested in. But Thea's story is much more compelling about her early years, and she should tell it, because I think it's fair to say that what she locked onto in the 1980s has influenced our collecting together, and moreover is singular in its in her prescience and ability to find the more important voices of that time.
Well, I was living in Washington. When I first got married, I moved to Washington. And I lived there and had three children. And very early on, my marriage was not particularly satisfying. And I was looking for something to build my interest and to get involved and get my arms around. And I started going to galleries, but much more important, I was working happily. I got identified by somebody, and I'll never know who or remember who, by the Kennedy Center, which was just getting ready to open in Washington, D.C. And I was I met with Roger Stevens and Martin Feinstein, who were then the directors, one for the performing arts and one more in administratively. And I think it was Lily Guest, and got identified as somebody who loved ballet, which I did. I was a very fat teenager, and I went every Saturday to the New York City Ballet, and I used to buy the cheapest seats, and the ushers got to know this little fat kid and moved me up closer and closer, and I just fell in love with dance. And I knew a lot about it at that time, and they understood that and put me in touch with American Ballet Theater. And then the then ambassador, actually it wasn't Martin Feinstein at that time, it was Blair, Ambassador Blair. And his wife had been identified by the New York City, by American Ballet, and I got involved. And little by little, I became really involved with the Kennedy Center, and very excitedly so. And after I got divorced, and I just knew that I needed to get back to New York, and all that time I was with great dancers and great choreographers and great set designers. And where did they want to go when they were in Washington? To the National Gallery, to the Freer, to the which is that?
Phillips
Collection. And it was just astounding, and I got more and more involved in the visual arts. And then I met Walter Hopps, and that was it. Mm. And then when I came back to New York...
Walter Hopps was obviously a big mentor in a sense.
In everything. He was then at the Corcoran Gallery of Art. He wasn't at the...
So that's quite the meeting that probably opened up all of those doors for contemporary art.
He was extraordinary. He was just extraordinary. And there wasn't a minute that he wasn't walking around Washington going into galleries. And the Washington art scene wasn't that interesting, so that he would be there and really make an effort to engage was extraordinary. And I was first started as a docent at the National Collection of Fine Arts, which was run by Josh Taylor, who was no less influential or intelligent as an American scholar. I mean, he was the first person that got me engaged, and then Walter was more into the contemporary. And my steps were not little. Mine, I was just, I had the luxury of moving back to New York, and even though I didn't have a single nickel and I was living in a 300 square foot efficiency, my kids were off to college, I didn't need to worry anymore about that, and Jeff and Christopher, who's the biggest influence in my life.
Christopher.
And all of these artists of the 80s in New York City, Bob Gober, Christopher Wolfe, Cindy Sherman, Sherry Levine.
These were all people you met when you came to New York.
When I came to New York, and they were, you know, they're just at the beginning, you know, really just...
Very exciting scene right then, right?
Incredibly so, and not as an art market, quite the opposite, but as a community of people. I tell the story ad nauseum.
Right, the East Village was kind of a community then, right?
It was a community. I mean, Colin DeLand, there was another guy that... Jamie Wolfe, Oliver Wazzo, and Karen... Sylvester. I mean, the people, some of the people that, whose names are not front and center anymore, but it was incredibly lively, and the only collector was Charles Saatchi, and the only market garbage you heard was from, there were two other people running around saying, oh, Charles bought this, Charles bought that, but that, you know, nobody serious paid much attention to that. And there was this place called Hawaii 5-0, and the reason we have wheels on our chairs was because of Hawaii 5-0. They had wheels on their chairs. And you could go to dinner there and start out with, you know, your table, but you could just wander around the restaurant on wheels and talk to everybody.
By pushing your chair around.
Just moving your chair. It was so much fun. And that's why we put this here. And by the way, when anybody is here, our friends come, nobody stays where they're sitting. You know, they just move around and talk to other people. It's great.
I like that. So then you were in New York and you began, I mean, again, before you met, you began starting your own advisory and you were selling work then as well.
Yes. I was starting the advisory, but the most important and exciting part of that was to be meeting these young artists and going to, you know, studios and listening to them and... going to museum shows with them. I tell so many of these stories so often. Going to a monographic museum show with an artist, it's amazing because they are there articulating the ideas behind the work, the way the work is made. I never imagined the complexity of Warhol screening until Christopher took me through the MoMA show in the 80s.
Right, that's interesting. I remember the Times had a series of articles, I don't know if they still do, with artists walking through the Met other museums.
Yeah, I haven't seen that.
It was wonderful. It was just such a, the artist's perspective was something else. So, but at that time also there weren't so much art fairs yet, when our art advisory meant building other people's collections, essentially, helping people understand how to build a collection.
Yes, how to build a collection, but for our practice, what I think is the thing that distinguished us is a little bit about psychotherapy, in the sense, is to try to get inside the head of the person that you're collecting for or helping collect, and to get something that makes them passionate. So it's not just about buying art. It's about expressing a vision that's theirs, not mine. So that I could have 10 clients and you would never know they were from the same advisor. Mm. They were all individual. And I think that's what's exciting about art. And I think that's what makes my life with Ethan so singular, is that it's our mindset. It's our unique approach and passions. And how we articulated that together is, I think, the baseline of the way we started. Right?
So let's jump to that. How did you guys kind of articulate that together?
Yeah, I think that what Thea was reflecting on a little earlier about her being drawn to the performers in ballet, the people that do the sets, the choreographers, if you will. The same thing is in the art world, and that is at the core of what we share as a couple that collects. We are drawn to creative minds. And I think that while we never sit down and fill out an application and come to the conclusion that, well, we're not as smart as these people at the end of an analysis, We know we're not. We know we don't have intellects that equal some of the people that are great artists. And one of the things about collecting, and I it's something that we share right to today and probably till we're no longer around, and that is a desire to be in conversation with people that are really interesting, that see the culture, see the time, see what's happening politically, comment on it with intelligence and insight, and hopefully with some humor. And that kind of experience is hard to get in life, and we found a way to get it. And we're deeply appreciative of the opportunities that we've had. We've earned them. We work for them. We found our way to them, and the payoff has been certainly life affirming and defining.
No question. And, yesterday we went, for example, to see Sam Lewitt's Airbnb, and he's an artist that is, to say the least, complex. And we tell the story and to each other a lot. The first, second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth audio studio with Sam. We finally get out on the seventh visit. Ethan gets out on the street and he said, "Hey, Thea, I think he dumbed it down for us. I got a little bit. I actually understand it." But we went to this Airbnb, which is part of a project that we're doing a book around with two of his galleries. And, you know, it's maybe 12 years we know this kid. Mm-hmm. He is no less interesting and compelling and mind-bogglingly brilliant than ever. And still we're only three quarters of the way there, and we'll keep going. And my guess is we'll never get there.
Well, of course, I love that because I feel the same way. My interest even in this, in doing all these interviews, I'm having conversation with all kinds of just fascinating artists and people from all over.
Should we apologize now for letting you down?
You know, it's funny. Everybody that I talk to says some version of that artist. Everyone feel like, you know, did I say the right thing? And I won't say who this particular person is, but it was the top curator of a major institution, the kind of people that most artists and people are somewhat intimidated by. And at the end of that talk, she said to me, did I sound all right? Did I said okay? And you know, I guess we all feel that way.
Yeah, but I want to follow up our comment and be very clear that when we speak about our relationships with artists, not that this is what you're taking out of it, but I do want to be absolute about it. We're not talking about happening to see somebody at a cocktail party or at a gallery opening. We're talking about in 20, 30, 40 examples where we have an ongoing conversation with artists, whether it's visiting with them in their studios, their being here, our being in their city, or and having dinner. I don't, the word that we work at it is a bit of a mischaracterization. We invest a lot because the return is so great. So we're willing to do that. And
I really want to correct that because I think you're giving the wrong impression. It's our life to do that. It's like eating.
These conversations in this
community. What am I saying that's different?
That it's we're working that. We're not working at it. We are lusting after it. It is not for us an effort.
Well,
it's
he was saying the return is so great, too.
That's true.
Which you return.
When I say work, I mean you're putting in energy, putting in time,
and the rewards are times 10.
And we're talking personal rewards of just intellectual excitement in relationships.
Yeah, just walking just out of a
it's life.
An evening and seeing a point of view about whatever that is unique that we wouldn't have thought
about. So let's talk about an example of this. It could be one artist or two, but that would articulate the way you've begun a relationship, collected work, let's say, from that artist, or it could be a few artists, and how that collection or that work perhaps then went to be gifted to a museum or something like that. Because this is also part of the fruit of the conversations and the work that you guys do, you know, albeit a labor of love, is that some of the work becomes acquired by both of you and then gets gifted to museums.
I understand the question. It's hard to extract individual names from the many we have these kinds of relationships with. Thea mentioned Sam LeWitt. His studio is down the hall in Brooklyn from Chaney Thompson, with who we see very, very often. We're close to him. His wife happens also to be an artist, Eileen Quinlan, and we're interested in her work. They have two children that we know that...
called Grandma Thea.
Called Thea Grandma Thea. So, you know, there are those two, those three... we just were at a dinner for Philippe Perrenot, who's doing a two gallery exhibition here in New York.
You've got to see that show.
Well, yeah,
don't
seen that yet.
Miss it. There are two. It's her Uptown space and her Chelsea space.
And Barbara Gladstone. We're talking about, right? Yeah.
And we would, any list would have to include Philippe, who typically when we're in Paris, we get together either at his home or out for dinner or both.
Which always starts with his studio. First, you go to the studio.
Okay. And, you know, Keith Tyson certainly would be in that category. We've known him since 1995. And very rarely are we in London when we don't have a get together with Keith. Again, sometimes in his studio, very often at dinner, or a day together looking at art. Yeah, there's a lot of artists that would...
But the other thing that I might add to that is yesterday...
Pablo Bronstein.
Oh, for sure. The list is too long. I mean, we'd have to do seven interviews to get there. But the yesterday is an example. I had gone to the galleries on Friday, and Ethan had a lot of paperwork to take care of at the office. And I came back, and I gave him a list because I had something to do yesterday. And he took the list and went to the galleries. And there was an artist that I hadn't really been following or looked at. We both saw the work at some major exhibition.
We saw it in Basel.
In Basel? At the Art Fair. And we had both kind of liked it. And I mentioned to him to go see the artist because it looked really interesting. And she was at the gallery when I was there, and we were talking about books because she had just published this big book, and she said she really liked making books. So I said, oh, that would be interesting. So I didn't promise to do it. I just took her card. So I mentioned Ethan to check it out, and when we got back, it turns out we both are attracted to the work, had been initially and still are, and that could be the beginning, and I'm not saying it will be, but that's the kind of thing that can be the beginning of a long association. The beginning of, okay, now let's go visit her in the studio. Okay, now let's maybe do a book with her. Whatever steps you take, and it can lead to an acquisition or not, but it certainly leads to wanting to know more.
And as this process creates acquisitions and you build a collection or collections, how is it grouped in the process when then, you know, you're giving a certain amount of work or loaning to a museum? That's part of a curatorial process, really, that you're both involved in, right? Putting together a body of work, or just correct me if I'm wrong in terms of that process for how part of your collection is,
well,
you know, leaves you.
I think that the first step is our response to the work, always the response to the work. If the response is there, then we pursue it. And typically that's to see as much of it as we can, to read about it, to see if there are insights about the work that or aspects of the work that we're not getting yet, and talking with other people about the work, but mostly looking. And then maybe there's a relationship develops, and it's predicated on... I think a very simple notion: if you're moved, intellectually, emotionally moved by a work of art, it seems to me ipso facto, why wouldn't you be interested in the person that made that work of art? We don't talk about that, but that's...
But it goes along with a lot of reading and research and discussion that we have, and that helps us ask the right questions. And I want to make clear that two things. One, we don't necessarily have to know an artist to acquire it, though most often we do. We also, when we were collecting at the beginning, it wasn't until 10 years ago that we started thinking that maybe this collection was significant enough to be contributed. And at that moment, Ethan had been talking about rooms of artists. So we've always collected in depth, which is what made him think about, okay, we'll give this to the museum and there'll be a room for this artist, a room for that artist. Well, that's physically impossible. Most museums don't have enough space to do that with our collection, never mind,
exactly,
as it grows and develops. So over the years, it became more curatorial for the institution. For us, it was driven by what we felt was important or interesting or compelling or just something we both loved enough to want to acquire. And so when you go through the Whitney, the installation and the combinations of work are uniquely theirs. And yes, we had a lot to do with the conversation around the exhibition and the curation of it. It was their curation. And there'll be other curations. We'll be dead and gone. And there'll be other ways that this work is used and learned from and interacts with objects in the collection or other borrowed exhibitions. And that's what's great about art. If it's good, years and years will pass and there'll be ways that it will help to inform the history of art.
Right, but what's also great about collectors like both of you is you've helped gather some of that work and transfer it to a museum so that the public can continue
exactly
to enjoy it. You said there seemed to be kind of almost a point where you think, okay, we have this group of work. Perhaps we should look at transferring that or gifting that to a museum. How does that process work? Is that by sheer number? Because obviously you're collecting more than can fit in your apartment or can be seen. How do you determine when a chunk of your collection should go to a museum? Because, of course, there's the other option of it going to auction or something like that.
That was out of the question. That was never the question. And our children are also incredibly generous. Mm-hmm. And none of them said, hey, wait a minute. Why are you not giving this to us? Mm-hmm. And I don't think as of 10 years ago, we were pretty wedded to the idea of making the contribution, how it was going to be made, to whom it was going to be made. And, all of that was not at all well developed in our heads, but contributing the work was, right?
Yeah, it was, I think, number one, as we're implying, there's 10 or 12 years ago, we just came to, and it had sort of evolved that collectively there was a lot of interesting, important work in the collection by historically important artists. But getting back to our relationships, and that was enough. But there's also the impulse on our part. Again, our kids have been fantastically supportive and interested in what we've done and all of that. But part of it is also we felt these artists deserve to be in museums. And you can't go through the kind of life that we've gone through, been privileged by the relationships that we've had. And we didn't feel we could turn around and say, hey, guys, this has been a lot of fun. We're going to sell your work now at Christie's or Sotheby's. That wasn't...
Right.
Never.
People have said, it makes me a little bit uneasy. I understand the statement, but people have commented, and I'm not being obsequious here. Well, this is very generous on your part. Neither Thea nor I have ever felt that this was about generosity. We felt this was what these artists deserve, period.
Because that's how it enters into the conversation of culture, basically,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
This is by getting to museums. When a museum gets a collection of yours or a portion of one, I mean, you talked about, obviously there's hindsight. You look back at what you've collected since the 80s, 90s, and some of these artists become very significant. They're names we all know. But I'm sure there's artists you've collected whose names aren't household names or that we don't know that. Do those names as well go to the museum, or is it a...
Yeah, that's such an interesting point because I think we'll both want to comment on this. One of the most gratifying experiences is having now donated 850 works to the Whitney and the Pompidou. I think has been...
I'm sorry, to interrupt, that's collectively 850 works to
collective,
the Whitney and the Pompidou?
It's about 550 to the Whitney and 300 plus to the Pompidou. Something in that neighborhood. It may be closer to 900 works. But the point that I want to make is that...
I was talking about the artists peripheral to the collection that may not have entered into the mainstream, but are coming along with a major.
The point that I was getting at was that in the course of the 2 years since we signed an agreement with each institution to donate these specific works, we've seen in a number of cases the understanding and appreciation of certain artists that going back several years were more or less unknown to the curatorial people in the two institutions, are now well known and appreciated. And that's rewarding because our belief in the artist, whether it's a well-known artist from the 80s or 90s or somebody that isn't as well known that really emerged in the aughts, that's very gratifying. It doesn't shock us.
Because you're contextualizing their place in history, right? You're also saying these are important artists, or these are the artists we like at the very least, but decades later they become part of the historic fabric, and if I'm understanding what you're saying correctly, by some of these artists who are not as well known being in there, what they're getting from this, or the museum and the art world in general, is that these artists also made a contribution.
Yeah, and the nicest part of all of this is that Elizabeth Sussman and Elizabeth Sherman, who were the curators of the Whitney exhibition, were amazingly professional in the way they went about learning about the artists that they didn't know. And there were several that they didn't know that well. And it turned out, for example, again back to Sam LeWitt, it actually resulted in Sam's work being included in the Whitney Biennial, and I think it was ultimately acquired by the Whitney. Mm-hmm. But the engagement that those curators had with artists that they didn't know, and even with the European artists that are included in the exhibition, they Skyped those artists. They couldn't visit the studios. They Skyped and talked and read and learned and engaged. And that's one of the reasons we chose the Whitney. They're desperately interested and seriously engaged with art-making practices and learning from artists directly, as did we. But, for example, there's Aaron Flint Jameson, whose work we saw at the Artist Space and were just totally won over, and we bought the entire exhibition. Well, he was new to everybody. Everybody. And the Whitney had to learn about it, and Miguel Abreu, who now represents him, had to learn about it, and we had to learn about it. And that was thrilling. And he's in the exhibition, and my guess is he'll be increasingly present in the international art world. Even if we're wrong, he'll be discussed and talked about because he's somebody who has a significant voice.
So. The case of Hito Sterl is also interesting because we bought the work, first came upon the work
years
through
ago.
A gallerist in Rotterdam, who was, I believe, her only gallerist at the time, and he wasn't particularly well known. It's kind of an esoteric though important program, and subsequent to our beginning to acquire the work, or coincident, I should say, she has really become one of the more important voices engaged with the politics of our time, of the world of artists. She's really a major, important artist. And so that sort of tracked with our own engagement with the work. We subsequently bought a couple of films, and today, you know, it's hard to look around without seeing her work being mentioned or her presence at a lecture or a panel discussion. And so, yeah, I think in answer to your question, that's exciting for us to see. Well, it always is, whether or not we gave the donation, you stake your belief in somebody, and that person continues to make work that you think is compelling or that we think is compelling. And if other people catch on to that and it's seen in wider circles, you know, it's kind of it's an interesting experience.
And that makes sense also to work with the Whitney, as you were saying, the kind of curatorial, I don't know what you want to call it, but acuity or interest, how they research. The Pompidou, I don't know a lot about that. Are they similar to the way that the Whitney receives and understands and begins to investigate a collection?
Yeah, they did something. It's interesting. Their reliance on the written word is interesting because...
very different than the American perspective,
very
right?
Different, and as are a number of things about the French. It's a different... It's a different culture. It's got its own nuances, and one of the things that we experienced was the catalog that the Whitney produced for the exhibition, and more for the collection that we donated, did not have any text about any artist. The artists are discussed in the interview that we did, and more importantly, in the essays that were written by Elizabeth Sussman, Elizabeth Sherman, and Christine Massel. But for the French version of the catalog, there's an essay on each individual artist. That's what the French public wants, and that's what they did. So, it's kind of... it's been an interesting experience having the donation go to two different, if you will, cultures.
And the curators there at the Pompidou, same kind of... because I also have the closest relationship to the Whitney of institutions. They do seem so accessible, so interested. Pompidou seems like the Metropolitan Museum to me, like it wouldn't have that kind of fluidity or ability to be flexible.
Well, when we first went to the Pompidou, Alfred Pacman was the president of the director of the Pompidou. And he sat us down at a table with all of his curators. And of the 27 artists that we were contributing to the Pompidou, 23 were on their wish list. And each curator came with a stack of folders about the artists in their division. And it was a very rewarding meeting. It hasn't always been at the Pompidou, but Christine Massel is also a very alive curator, and she managed to create a very interesting exhibition, and we're very happy.
Which we've only seen in plan form, but she's got a good mind, and she understands the art that she's dealing with, and when you do the kind of thing that we've done, I think the fact that the institutions appreciate the work and the artists that we've donated, and that you've got an ongoing collegial relationship with the people that were involved in making the catalog and are involved in making the exhibitions, that's a plus out of this thing. And we chose well. Maybe lucky, but we chose well in the Whitney, and we chose well in the Pompidou for those reasons. And then on top of it, at the Whitney, working with Adam Weinberg has been
the best.
An incredible joy, because he's a first and foremost a really fine person. He's knowledgeable about art. He
passionate about
he's
art.
He's passionate about art.
Longest-running Whitney director.
He understood what we were doing. He appreciated what we were doing. And he wasn't reluctant to say so and treat us in the most kindly ways. And it was always informed by the art, but it's been sensational.
Now, working with museums, as opposed to having the relationships with the museums you have, some collectors have their own kind of space, right, up in upstate New York or Connecticut or somewhere, start creating these spaces because all your collection in these institutions will most likely not be shown. Like you were saying, talking about rooms of artists, that's what we'd like to see, but doesn't happen. You know, from what I know, you've continued this relationship with museums. Instead of building some gorgeous architecturally designed piece that houses your collection and your own curator, have you thought about that route?
There are two things to be said about that. First, it was never in the cards for us because that's not the kind of financial wherewithal we have. And second, it isn't anything that suits our idea of what, where, and how art can be used most effectively, which is through the eyes of other intellectuals. And I'm not saying that private institutions, I mean, the Freer was a private institution. The
Frick, the Morgan,
Frick,
probably,
the
Morgan, I don't know.
There are a number of them all over the world that become public institutions. That wasn't going to happen to us, and because we've always collected the art of our times, having other curators work with it and see it through their eyes was always very important to us. Secondly, we had talked to a number of different institutions about the possibility of contributing the collection. The Whitney was without a doubt the most engaged intellectually with the works and the most clear in the way they really needed and wanted the collection, without any question. And it was largely through them that we then went to the Pompidou. Then the other thing, the sort of off to the side, Adam and Elizabeth Sussman have been personal friends of mine for well over 30 years. And when Ethan and I got together, we shared that friendship. And it was very easy to work with them. And part of what you want in your life is an enlivened conversation that's stimulating, that's challenging, but that isn't contentious and that doesn't focus on things outside of the art itself. And God knows that's the Whitney times 10.
Yeah, I just want to underline a portion of what Thea said. We never contemplated doing that. It wasn't financially viable, but it wasn't that precluded our thinking about it. I think we're disposed, as Thea was saying earlier, and maybe one of your questions earlier focuses on this, that if you believe in these artists as we do, the legacy is to have those artists up against, along with, juxtaposed to whatever history brings forward. An established museum, like the Pompidou, for sure, like the Whitney, for sure, affords the artists that we've identified and we're won over by the opportunity to go through the future and allow their voice to be heard in different ways and under different circumstances. We're confident about these artists that we're interested in. And it's a thrill to think that, you know, they'll be out there, how should I say it, dealing with the future, I guess. How people see this time, if we've done anything, we've given them the opportunity.
A snapshot
to,
of that whole time. Yeah, it seems also the Whitney, and I don't know if this connection follows, but the Whitney may have influenced the development of so many of the artists that they then received from you because of, and I don't know how many went through it, but their independent study program. I haven't interviewed Ron Clark, but I'd like to, because it seems to be hugely influential to late 70s and 80s artists. Absolutely. I mean, to me, when I think of the art world, and I may be overestimating their influence, but it seems to come right out of that program, this way of thinking about ideas about art, this whole expanded notion of not just conceptual thinking, but how broad painting and everything can be, would seem like they actually helped create a lot of those artists that you...
Interesting. Without a doubt. I would say that since we began the process, since we first sat down with Adam and Elizabeth, insofar as the Whitney is concerned, I'm betting that we've heard in conversation, because you take note of it, this is now the museum that, one of the museums we're giving a lot of work to, you take note of the incredible number of times, it's got to be 100 times that Whitney Independent Study Program has spilled out of the mouth of somebody we're in a conversation with. Mm-hmm. And there's the heightened awareness of that because of our now history with the Whitney. And it's kind of eye-opening. Funny story, in the 90s, we became intrigued with the work of Gary Hill. And we're admirers of his and we're friends of his. And he has a daughter that is the actor, if you will, in a piece called Remarks on Color, in which she's about 9 years old at the most. She's reading Wittgenstein, which, props to her, she probably didn't understand at the time. And that becomes kind of the essence of the dead-on work with her holding the book and the camera on her. And about a year ago, we stay in touch with Gary. About a year ago, that same daughter showed up in New York and paid us a visit, and she was just beginning the Whitney Independent Study Program.
And she's now an artist.
And she's now a practicing artist, right.
Huh. Amazing, but she was really schooled in that program from a young age. We can almost say.
Oh, she's wicked smart. She's
wow,
like, oh,
that's fascinating. And so maybe in closing, we should talk a little bit about the future. You guys have written a book, done all kinds of wonderful things. You'll be these mature collections being transferred. I imagine you continue to collect. Is there other projects or ideas for the future? Will it be, I mean, there doesn't have to be, will it be continued collections, or is there publishing and other things that you want to do?
We are going to continue to collect. There's just no question. It's impossible not to. It's just impossible. And it's improbable. And the other thing that we're doing with a great deal of enthusiasm is continuing to publish artist books. And to do artist projects, we have a space in our office, and it's easy for us to invite people or allow people who want to do certain things that are not gallery appropriate to host them at our office. We're doing a project the 23rd with Lena Henke with Real Fine Arts. We're doing we're hosting Gilles Presti and Emmanuel Campoli. They're bringing Christian Bonfoy to the office. They're going to do an installation and introduce his work to New York. And we have at least a half a dozen book projects on the
agenda. Yeah, we've got a book project under discussion as of a recent trip to Mexico City with Jan Vo. We've been talking to Yuta Kota about a book. We've got the book with Sam LeWitt underway. So, and as Thea said, we're continuing to collect. And, it's a different time for us. We're no longer involved in the art advisory firm that Thea started in the mid-80s, early 80s. And so we've got a little bit more freedom in our schedule to travel. And when we travel, we typically look at, the art that's around. We have a trip coming up to...
And by the art that surrounds her, Trump, contemporary living artists,
yes,
always? Is that a...
Yeah, but we'll see historical shows with great enthusiasm, but we're always looking. We're going to be in... we've been asked to do a talk in Barcelona. So we're going to get around to the art scene in Barcelona. There's no way for us to avoid that. Then we're going on for a little vacation in Portugal. So we have a couple of friends there, and I'm sure Julia Sarmento is going to guide us to a few galleries in Lisbon. So yeah, that's
and when you ask just contemporary, not at all. We're always going to major museums and very historic work, and in fact.
So collecting historic work as well.
We don't collect it, the historic work.
But it informs the way we look at contemporary.
Informs the way you think. And, sure. I mean, art history is just too fascinating for words. And if you're in Dresden and you don't go and see the Kranichs, you're out of your mind.
Right.
And we do that regularly. And we always pretend that we could actually shop the museum. And we always say, which would you take out of this show? We almost always choose the same work of art. We play the game that we could actually buy Rembrandt. It doesn't quite happen that way. But it's fun to pick the one you would buy.
Mm.
And it's a lot of fun to play that game because it gets you to kind of go back and pretend. And it's just...
I can't speak... on behalf or for or understanding all collectors, because I know that there are a lot of collectors that find satisfaction in seeing the value of what they buy go up, and that seems to be the bulk of it. But there are a lot of collectors out in the world that are really engaged with the art of their time or even earlier periods. But speaking of people that collect contemporary art, I think it's a way to, it's a lot of things, but it's also a way to say you're alive, that you're testing your mind to understand something that's a stretch, it's a reach, it takes some effort, it's not simple, it's not a coloring book with a simple text, it's complex, it's challenging, it can be difficult for the best of minds. So I think that that's part of what collectors do. They assert their ability to say, yeah, I get this, it moves me, it stimulates me, and I'm alive.
And to close, as a perfect example of that, we discovered Cameron Rowland's work a while back, and he opened up a language and a vocabulary and a way of thinking,
yeah,
that is so radically new for us and so essential to our time. I mean, you almost cannot be on this planet now and not try to understand what he's doing. And he's, yes, there are people historically that relate to Cameron, Hans Hacke for sure, but he has extended the vocabulary of contemporary art in a majestically interesting way. And how would you ever get the excitement, the thrill, the knowledge, the reason for waking up at the next day without stumbling on somebody like Cam, who's going to he's going to change our lives. And I feel about Cameron the way we felt about Hito a number of years
or
ago.
Or many other, Jan Vo, or any of them.
I mean,
Henrik Olsson.
There's so many artists that we saw for the first time years before you saw them in galleries and around. I mean, we saw Jan Vo at the Caddis Foundation, and that chandelier that's hanging at the Whitney was bought at the Caddis Foundation. I don't even think... Did he have a gallery then?
He did. But the flip side of your question or the flip side of the answer is it's very difficult when you've had these kinds of experiences where your mind has been so stimulated to all of, why give it up? As long as you're, you know, maybe in my case, I like to slow it down a little bit. I'm getting into spending late afternoon, early evening reading historical accounts. But when you have the kind of experiences that we're talking about, like Cameron Rowland or Aaron Flint Jameson or name them, it's, you know, what did Larry Clark say?
Right, it's about the
once?
Pure joy of life itself and the intellectual enthusiasm that you're both enjoying.
Yeah, once that needle's in, it's hard to give it up.
Ethan and Thea, thank you so much for talking with me today. Oh. It's really been a pleasure.
Our pleasure. We're glad to do it.
Thank you for taking so much time with us. It was very, very sweet of you.
You're listening to Yale Radio WYBC. This is Brainerd Carey with the lives of the artists, architects, curators, and more.